So I don't think y'all are Yankees. I don't know what y'all are, but y'all ain't Yankees. Y'all remind me of the Oklahoma Sooners. I knew that'd get a rise out of you. That's a bad term up here now, especially, isn't it? Sorry about that. Makes you feel any better, they stomp our ass too. I'm Mary Pearl, and they call me Murp, and I'm an Al-Anon who is happy, joyous, and free. I'm happy, joyous, and free because I try to live and work the program that was given to us by Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps. Now, I do not work the 12 steps like maybe some of y'all are familiar with working them. Now, I'm not here to teach. I'm not here as an authority. I'm not here anything to share my experience and how I work the steps. Now, I am a big book, black belt, Al-Anon. Long before Al-Anon came up with the 12 and 12, I had been using the AA 12 and 12. Having read the Al-Anon 12 and 12, had not found it necessary to go to the Al-Anon 12 and 12. That's just how it is. We've got several pieces of literature in Al-Anon which are excellent. And then we've got some that I'm not real thrilled with. And that's one of them. We have another one called Blueprint for Progress. And for what it's designed to do, it's the most ineffective piece of literature I think I've ever seen. Now, I made this observation to the lady who wrote it. And at the time, I didn't know she had written it. She explained to me real quickly, she had. And I told her, I said, well, I still, what I said stands. That's how it is, you know. That's why I'm saying it's my experience. Not necessarily yours. And I am not knocking any of our literature other than those two pieces. But for me, and perhaps some of you are like me somewhat, in that you have not been just a little garden variety, sweet little person that stayed home and martyred while her husband drank. That was not my deal. I have, as I'm going to share with you, I have in this step thing, well, you never know where we're going, but there's a lot of things that I share when I'm working through the steps that I don't normally share. So you're going to know me real well, chances are, by the time this is over. I want you to know that I do qualify for the Al-Anon program, and the reason I say I qualify, there's a lot of people who qualify for the Al-Anon program. They are associated, have been affected by someone's alcoholism, but that doesn't make me an Al-Anon. What makes me an Al-Anon is the fact that I qualify for Al-Anon, I attend Al-Anon on a regular basis, I work the 12 steps of the program in my life, and I try to help other people whose lives have been affected by alcoholism. And to me, that's what an Al-Anon is. Now, I don't know if you're out there, and I may walk on some toes, and if so, that's good. It might get you to thinking. But at home, we have a group of people that go with their husbands to open AA meetings and consider themselves Al-Anons. Well, that's a member, that's just a open meeting attender as far as I'm concerned. And I despise to hear an alcoholic refer to his or her spouse or loved one as my little Al-Anon when they don't go and they don't attend and they don't work. That's one of those things that rubs me the wrong way, and that brings out one of my character defects, and it's sarcasm. And I have to tell them about it. You know, I've got another thing. I've been born with a need to tell everybody everything I know all the time. And I know a whole bunch. And I talk a whole bunch. But I'm not a teacher, and I'm not an authority. I'm just going to share with you this weekend how I work the steps in my life. Now, when I was born, I qualified for Al-Anon. Just by the act of being born. Nothing I did on my own. But my mother's father, my grandfather, my maternal grandmother, an aunt and two uncles, alcoholics on my mother's side of the family. On my father's side of the family, there was one alcoholic. So when I arrived, I qualified. But did you know we didn't call them alcoholics back then? They were drunks. And I don't know that they even knew what the word alcoholism meant. But all my life, I knew what alcoholism was. It was what my grandpa was. And he was an under-the-bridge wino. what most people think an alcoholic is. And when this man drank, he got violent. And he would cause a lot of hell at home when he drank. So therefore, anyone who went out and drank, came home, had a bunch of trouble, this was an alcoholic. Now, it's important you remember that, because this is what an alcoholic was going to be to me. And this was what I perceived alcoholism to be. What are we doing? What's making this squeak, Peggy? Okay, you fix it. She'll be joining us for the next meeting. Too close, huh? Get a beat with that and you got it made. You ever notice the fixers of the world? They're right there. Okay. The alcoholics in my life, like I say, my grandfather's drinking embarrassed and humiliated me when I came in contact with him. Now, I didn't come in contact with him that often because he was sort of one of those people that you never went to visit and you hope he never came to see you. And he lived behind the seawall in an old bus. And this was like an old school bus. And he had him a little hot plate in there. And that's how the man lived. And this was what alcoholism was to me. So, as you see, I was a qualifier for Al-Anon. But this drinking did not affect my life other than the few times that I was embarrassed when he would tell somebody we were related. Other than that, I didn't really care what he did or didn't do. I can remember a few times when the man came to our house and he wasn't drinking. And those were pleasant times. He was a lot of fun. He could tell stories. His family came over in the covered wagons. He was in his 80s at that time. So I had mixed messages about it. You know, it's funny how somebody can be neat at one time and then be a completely different person over here. But I wasn't around it very much, so it wasn't any big deal. Now, so I have all those family members that are alcoholic. Now, the man that I married the first time became an alcoholic. Now, he didn't become or admit to alcoholism until after we were married. That worried me. You know how they say he didn't drink till he met you? Well, he didn't drink till he left me. Now, how about that? I didn't know till years later that he became an alcoholic, so obviously I had married to a dry alcoholic. And that explains a lot of the irritability, restlessness, and discontent in our home. I've always been a victim. I could find these people everywhere. I have a doctor who is an alcoholic, a dentist who is, a veterinarian is a close friend who is. I have all these people. I seem to be a carrier. And I think the reason is, it's my own addiction. Now, my drug of choice is adrenaline. I'm addicted to excitement. And if I don't have some, I'll make some. That's the way it's been all my life, as far back as I can remember. I will do anything to get attention. I will even come to Bellevue and talk on the steps. Anyway, I want to tell you today that those are some of my early observations about alcohol and what my personality, how I was going to be affected. You see, I noticed alcoholics got a lot of attention. And you know, it's always exciting when you're around alcoholics. So this was going to feed the sickness that was within me. Now, in order to work the steps, there are some musts. You know, I love it when people say, there are no musts. Well, we got an expression at home, there's some damn well betters. And one of those, for me, is having a sponsor. That, to me, was one of my most important tools in working the steps. It's very difficult to do anything by yourself, and the premise that we use here in the fellowship is that you no longer have to do anything alone, and then we will try to work the steps alone. You ever notice that? How we fight getting a sponsor? I don't want anyone to tell me what to do. I know everything. And then there's some smart aleck who'll say, your best thinking got you here. You don't like that. You know, that's an observation you don't care too much about. But that's the truth. Our best thinking and acting got us here. So now, my sponsor is like a tour guide. That's the way I think of her. Now, I love to travel, and I love to go on tours. And the reason I love to go on tours is that I have a certain amount of time and a certain amount of money that I want to spend on a vacation. And in order to get the most for my time and my money, I want to know where to go, and I want somebody to tell me where not to go. All those places that you think they're going to be wonderful, and they'll say, you don't want to go there because that sucks. You know, all right? So your sponsor's the same way. This person knows how to work the steps. They've been there. A tour guide's been there. They know the territory. They know all about it. They can give you this information, and they might can save you going off on these little side-end detours that's going to waste your time and money. And that's how I was when I came to the program. I wanted to do this thing. At first, I wanted to do it by myself because my ego was such. But then after I tried that and it doesn't work. You know, you can go to meetings. I went to meetings for the first year. I was in a meeting every night. Now, that's 365 meetings in 365 days. That's pretty good. Didn't change one darn thing. I was going to meetings. I didn't have time to do anything. I was going to meetings. And I was getting that reinforcement every night at the meeting. But I wasn't changing anything. I was hearing about resentments, and I'd say, yeah. And then I'd come home, and I'd hear about self-pity, and I'd say, yeah. And then I'd hear about all this stuff, and I'd come home, and I'd say, yeah. Nothing changed. Because I wasn't doing anything. I was just going to the meetings. So, you know, it's just like going to the meetings doesn't help in itself any more than sitting in the garage makes you a car. You're going to have to do something different. And so something different was working the steps. And I could not understand. You know, they have them on the walls in every one of the meeting rooms. You know, they have them. I could see where my husband needed to do those. In fact, I'd go with him to the open meetings occasionally, and I'd be there to highlight the important things by giving him an elbow. Or I would come home and I would record stuff, and then I would play it in the tape recorder at home so that he'd be sure and get it. And it never entered my mind that I might need this same kind of help. I would see the things that he needed, but you see, I was perfect. Now, I don't say that it takes everybody a year to recognize there's something wrong with them, you know. But when I came in, we did not have step meetings for Al-Anons in Arkansas. We didn't have them. It wasn't available. And every once in a while in one of our regular meetings, somebody might mention or they'd read the steps, but nobody ever talked about working the steps. So it's sort of confusing. It's just that stuff that you go through while you sit over there and you do your nails and what have you and get ready to tell them how bad it is at home. That's what the steps were for me. Wasn't a big deal. Well, my sponsor pointed out to me that the steps were for me. And I said, but which ones? I mean, I'm not powerless over alcohol. I can drink alcohol anytime I want to. And alcohol doesn't make my life unmanageable. And she'd just look at me. And I'd say, come to believe that a power greater than ours, there is no power greater than me. I can take care of myself. And if there's no power greater than you, why in the hell would you turn your will over to it? It just didn't make any sense at all. And I said, the only thing that makes any sense at all is I can't keep him from drinking, and I'll carry that message. And that's what I did. That's how I worked those 12 steps in the beginning. And my sponsor had to set me down. Okay, so now you've got a sponsor that's going to help you. But the regular meetings are important because you do need to hear what everybody has to say. And that bothered me. Have you ever get in a meeting with somebody that's just never says anything you ever want to hear? We've got a girl at home, God love her, and I don't care what the question is, her answer never fits the question. Y'all got them too, I see that. Okay. It doesn't make any difference if you said, we're going to talk on resentment, she'll say, I made a quilt last week. And when she gets through talking, she always says, now, I don't know if that fits the question or not. And I said, no, it never does, but we're always interested in what you have to say. I learned a lot from her. Oh, I learned a lot of patience and tolerance from that girl. But these were the regular meetings. I think it's important to have your home group where you go to your regular meetings, where people get to know you. You know, there's a lot of times you can flip from group to group to group to group, and nobody ever really knows who you are. That's real neat. You know, you can just sort of swarm in anytime you want to and tell them how wonderful you are and leave. But with the regular meetings at a home group, I then had to have three things that I didn't have at all. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I didn't know how to be honest. I don't know if you've had that problem. I did not know how to be honest. I lied so much, I didn't know the truth. There was no way that I could put a finger on the truth. And as being an open mind, I had an idea about everything, and that's how it was, and I never changed my opinion. Because if I did, that meant I might have been wrong. And so you can't afford to be wrong, so you don't change your opinion. And that way you're never wrong. Can you relate to that? Okay. I had some other tools that I used along the way besides the sponsorship and besides going to the meetings and with my trying to develop an open mind and become willing to do it. Pain's always been a good motivator for me. You know, if you hurt bad enough, you'll be willing to move from where you're at to another place. And I found that in the beginning when I came into the program, I had tremendous pain tolerance. Thank God today I don't have that kind of pain tolerance. That's the kind that keeps banging into the closed door saying, this time it's different. I'm going to make it this time. I had that kind of tolerance. I could stand that till my face got flat. Okay. Now, I believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it doesn't make any sense to me to take 12 steps out of the big book and not read the rest of the book any more than it would be to read the 23rd Psalm and say, don't read the rest of the B-I-B-L-E. And in that book and in the 12 and 12 are the exact directions, the specific directions. And if you are feel funny about that as an Al-Anon, read the foreword to the 12 and 12. It tells you that it is a book for anyone who is trying to work the 12 steps. It doesn't say this book was written for alcoholics. It said it's written for anyone who is trying to recover through the use of the 12 steps. Our Al-Anon family groups, the Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, the first edition, The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage helped me tremendously in communication. There was just a lot of things. We do have a lot of excellent, excellent Al-Anon material. But like I say, the big book and the 12 and 12 probably changed my life more than anything. If you read, especially on steps 4 and 10 in the 12 and 12, those two things had more impact on changing my life and making me aware of who I was and what I was doing and where I was going. Now, how did I get to Al-Anon? I've got all this qualification, and you've heard how I got in Al-Anon, what I did that first period of time, but how did I get there? I issued an ultimatum to my husband. That's how it started off. I issued an ultimatum. My husband drank, and he got in a lot of trouble when he drank. He got me in a lot of trouble when he drank. He would drink in places I'd get thrown out of. He would put himself in situations that it was necessary that I go to jail. His behavior was just intolerable. And, you know, I got tired of taking the kind of abuse that I was putting out. And so I issued an ultimatum, and I said to the old boy, I said, you know, you're going to have to quit drinking. And he said, or what? And I said, or you're going to have to get out. Well, now, this terrorized him because I was working and he wasn't. I was providing him money to drink on. You know, I mean, I was taking care of the man, let's face it. And so it terrorized him to know that I was beginning to cut off all these resources. Now, I had threatened this many times, but you know how there comes the day that you really mean what you say, and they seem to know and sense that this is the day. And so he made this statement, I'm sick. And I said, that's right, you're sick. And he said, I don't know why I do what I do. And I said, I don't either. And he said, but there's just something that comes over me. I don't go out to get drunk. And I said, well, we'll take you to the doctor and find out what's wrong. Now, we went to the doctor, and the doctor found out what was wrong with me. Because I'd been coming to him for a long time with a list of complaints. And he would say, is there everything all right on your job? And I'd say, yes. And he'd say, how about home? Fine! You know that little white knuckle, thin lip? Fine! So now he knew there was a drinking problem in our home, because that's how my husband expressed it. He said, I have a slight drinking problem. And the doctor said, well, perhaps you may be an alcoholic. He said, I don't know. All I know is that if you have a drinking problem, there's nothing I can do about it. You should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my husband was appalled. And he said, I'm not an alcoholic. And I said, that's right, he's not. I mean, he didn't drink like my mother's family drank. He was not an alcoholic. But he had some friends who had gotten a prescription for some little pills. And they were called Anabuse. And my husband said, that's what I want. All my friends are taking antabuse. Didn't he have lovely friends? So I went home, and what I heard the doctor say was, here is a pill that if he takes it, he can't drink. Now, that's not what the man said. But, you know, we hear what we want to hear. We see what we want to see, and this is what I heard and saw. So I went home with my little prescription for antabuse, and I got it filled, and I made sure that he got a pill every morning. Now, I had high blood pressure. We have an epileptic dog, and J.D. was on the pill. Every morning in a rush, I can't guarantee you who got what, but everybody got a pill. Now, what have I been saying all these long years of alcoholic drinking? If he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. And he had, and I wasn't. Now, that's a bummer. No matter how you look at it, that is a bummer. But it's still his fault. I was not ready to become responsible for my own actions at that point. So everything, I was always a victim. And there was always someone or someone else to blame. Before J.D., it was that boy I was living with. Before that one, it was that husband. Before that, it was my mother. Before that, there's always been someone in my life that's made my life miserable, I thought. And I would blame these people all my life. So now here's J.D., and he's not drinking, but my life is miserable because we are suffering. He's suffering from alcoholism, untreated alcoholism. I'm suffering from Al-Anonism, untreated Al-Anonism. And we're having this happy little home. Now, a little typical scene in our happy little home is I come in from work, and he's working now. You know, he hasn't any excuse. He can go to work now. And I took him to work. Not that I didn't trust him, but I gave him a dime for emergency phone calls. And I would go pick him up from work and bring him home, and I would say, honey, what would you like for dinner? And he would say, anything. I'd say, how about fried chicken? No, I don't want fried chicken. Well, what do you want? Anything. Well, how about spaghetti? I hate spaghetti. Well, what do you want? Anything. So I would fix anything, and he would look at it, and he'd say, I'm not eating that. And I'd say, well, you have a choice. See, even before Al-Anon, I knew there were choices. I said, you have a choice. You can eat it or wear it. Sometimes he chose to wear it. He would go in to get dressed, and he would say, what do you want me to wear? And I'd say, I don't care. He'd say, lay me out something. I would. He'd say, I'm not wearing that. What do you mean you're not wearing it? I don't like that. Well, then you pick it out. You know I can't pick out things. Well, what do you want to wear? I don't know. Now, these are just little things, but these are the little things that drive you insane. These are this little happy time that you're at home. See, he's not drinking. When he was drinking, we didn't have these problems. He never ate. And he escaped and dressed before I got home. So these were problems that we didn't have. Wasn't sobriety wonderful? He was stark raving sober. We began to play this little game. It's called war. Whoever dies, the other one wins. It seemed like he was put on earth just like my mother to make my life miserable. I hated him. I absolutely hated him because it wasn't okay. My life was not okay, and it's his fault. So then I decided, you know, if it's not his drinking, it just must be him. Well, I'll get rid of him. Now, divorce was not an option. I'd been married before. I'd had a mistaken marriage. You know, if you pick one wrong guy, everybody's entitled to a mistake. But if you have another, and there's something wrong, you know, it might look like something's wrong with your picker. And nobody wants a broken picker. So I thought, you know, it would be nice, instead of being a divorcee, that's such an X-rated word, you know, and all your friends knock on you when you're a divorcee. And so I thought, maybe if he had, a widow sounded good. So maybe if he'd just die. He wasn't dying fast enough. I'd watch him for signs. And he'd say, oh, I'm dying. And I'd, and he'd wake up. So I began to dream about his dying. It was so wonderful he was going to die. Now, I never planned the funeral. I just got off on the homicide. Now, there had been a point in my life back before he ever entered it, I considered suicide very seriously. Obviously, I didn't do very well with it. But homicide sounded like a better deal. And so I began to think of ways to kill him, and it was not necessarily kill him in my mind. It was ways for him to die. And it was okay for him to die, because if you were living like I was living, you would understand. If you were on a jury, how in the world would you convict a poor, sweet thing like me when I would tell you of this terrible way I'm living, about the spaghetti and about the socks and the shoes? There's no way that you would ever, ever say that there was anything wrong with me having him removed. And so I began to think about how to remove him. And my favorite was take an ice pick, stab him in the neck, and watch him drip. Doesn't that just give you goosebumps? I loved it. Then there was the back over him with the car routine. You always keep good tires on the car. You want to leave those little marks so you can leave your identity. You know, the idea of the police catching you and finding you. I mean, I was going to tell them, I did it. It was like I was going to get the gold medal at the Olympics. I did it. And then I read in the newspaper at home where a woman had killed her husband under similar circumstances, and they put her away. And I thought, what a rotten thing to do. And so now I begin to get a little sicker. And I said, you know, it has to be the perfect crime now. And that left out all those good ones, because you got to be a little sneaky about it now. And I thought, you know, he's going to drink sooner or later. He always does. See, intuitively, I knew that this was not going to work. And I said to myself, what we need to do is, aha, if a drunk were to pass out and drown in the bathtub, who would know? I still think it'd work. I've always liked that one. It sounds good to me sometimes, even today. And I began to think on that. I begin to think about that, and I begin to wait. Now, I have infinite patience when it comes to waiting for revenge. I've never had any problem with that. I believe in slow, premeditated revenge. I can wait forever. And I knew that sooner or later he was going to drink again, and I could put the plan into practice. I knew it was going to happen. And sure enough, the year to the week that he quit drinking, J.D. got drunk. And we had ice and snow on the ground. And lo and behold, when he came in, he wiped out our hitching post horse, which was cast iron, at the end of the drive. He came fleeing across the yard, bounced into the redbud tree, and then hit the side of the house. And I thought, gosh, he lost control on the ice and snow. No. He opened that truck door and he poured out. And I'd seen that too many times, and I knew he was drunk. And I looked out my window, and I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. Now, the significance of this is, I don't know about you, but you see, the longer I think on something and the longer I meditate on something, the more likely I am to act upon what I've been thinking. So here I was. J.D. came through the door. We had a little ritual we used to play when he'd come through the door. He would stand in the door and he'd say, hey, bitch. And I'd say, have you been drinking? The most brilliant statement in the world. And he would say, no. Or only two. Only two. When I ask or hear anybody talk about they had six drinks, I know they're not alcoholic. No alcoholic has ever admitted to more than two. So we didn't play this little game this time. When he opened the door, I just hit him. Because that's what always happened before. I would get mad and hit him. And when he fell, he hit the coffee table and it knocked him out. So I drug him across our floor, in the living room, down the hall, into the bathroom. And I took his clothes off of him. I ran the bathtub full of water, and I put him in, and I held him under until the bubbles quit coming. Because I hated him, and I wanted him dead. And then this voice came inside my head, and it said, you can't do this. Look at what you're doing. And I picked him up by the hair of the head, and I said, the hell I can't. And I put him back down again. And then the voice came back and it said, you're committing murder. You're taking the life of someone you once loved. And that like to have scared me to death. You see, I didn't think up until that moment, that was the first moment that the idea that what I was doing was premeditated murder, that was the first realization, the moment of sanity in a long period of mental illness leading up to that point, not realizing I was getting that emotionally sick. And fortunately, I was able to jerk him out of the tub, and I had worked for the Red Cross years before, and I resuscitated him. Now, you'd say, this got her to Al-Anon. No. No. It takes what it takes. That got him to AA. Now, that act in itself did not. But he liked to die over that particular drunk. He had alcoholic poisoning. I didn't even know what it was. All I know is I heard him scream and beg for help and what have you, and I wouldn't even go in and see about him. And he liked to hemorrhage to death. But I came home from work. Isn't it funny how I could justify, because justification and rationalization were dear friends of mine, and I could sit there and I could look at that situation, which I did for several hours. I rocked in my chair in the living room and thought about what had just happened. And I said, you know, if he hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have had to do that. And you see, that was a lie because I'd been planning that for a long time. But I couldn't look at that. So you lie to yourself and you swallow down and you put it in a frame where you can stand to live with it. And that's why I had done things that were unacceptable all my life. Things that I was ashamed of, things that I was afraid of, things that I had done, thoughts. I'd put them back and say, oh, well, if you were in this situation, you'd have done this too, and it's okay. And that's how I went. But when J.D. was able to come out of that room again, I came home from work, and I saw him at our bar, and he was shaking. He was trying to drink a cup of coffee, and he was shaking so hard he was not having much success. And he said, would you call Alcoholics Anonymous for me? I must be an alcoholic. And that was the beginning of his recovery. Now, I was not real thrilled. I took him to his first AA meeting, and by the way, it was only 6 blocks from our house, and it was an hour later from the time I called that night. They just happened to be having their once-a-week meeting at that time back then. But anyway, I went there, and I was appalled about having to go in a room with a group of drunks. God, can you believe that? You know, it's bad enough having one in the house, but they have to go in a whole room with them. And when I got there, they were really weird people, too, I'll tell you. They didn't even dress like drunks were supposed to dress. I didn't see a one of them that looked like Grandpa, except there was this one guy that had a sweater on that looked like a colander. It had so many little burnt holes all over it, you know. And that, of course, had to be the one that J.D. homed in on and asked to be his sponsor. Now, Durwood looked worse than Grandpa did when we put him away. I was not real impressed. And they told me that night there was Al-Anon for me. And I looked at them and I said, what? They said, we have Al-Anon. It's for you. And I said, there's nothing wrong with me. And I was very sincere. And I was just very offended that they said, should suggest there was something wrong with me. But they gave me some literature, which I paid no attention to whatsoever. I wouldn't read that trash. But I didn't throw it away. And I put it in my desk at home. And J.D. started going to those meetings. Now, that's terrible. He was gone more now than he was when he drank. I didn't like it. He was out late, and he would say they were talking. I knew what he's talking about. Yeah, I knew. He's telling everything I'd ever done to him. He was out there blowing his guts. I knew. I didn't want to hear that. And then one night, he didn't come home. It was getting later, and this girl had given me a card, just had a little name, said, my name's Arlene. If you ever need to talk, give me a call, and her phone number. And I picked up that, and I called her that night, and I said, him and that old reprobate that he calls a sponsor, they're both out drunk. I know they are. And she said, no, they're probably not. And when he came in, he told me they'd been playing Moon. Now, that worried me. Now, if y'all don't have Moon up here, it's a domino game. But what I thought Mooning was, I thought, my God. And at his age, whoo! But anyway, all of this got me so frustrated that J.D. came home and made the best announcement he could have made in 100 years, and that was, guess what? I got fired today. And I couldn't believe it. What do you mean you got fired? You worked one or two days a week drunk for 10 years. You've been working every day. They told me I'm fired. Well, I'll find out why. So I called his boss and demanded to know why they had fired my husband. And he told me that I didn't work there and it wasn't any of my business and hung up. How rude. Now, I didn't want y'all to get the idea I was a manager and controller. That I had any idea what was going on. But this seemed to be the last straw for me. Because it was so threatening. All of a sudden now, that job that J.D. had had where he had worked one or two days a week, that was not that much income, but it was the idea there was none. And this frightened me. And so I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I wanted to know how to manage when there's nothing left to manage. That's what I wanted to know. And I wanted to know, how do you keep an alcoholic sober? That's all I wanted to know. And you know, they couldn't help me at all. That was so disgusting. They said, we don't know. And that's depressing when you go and you're, I mean, all you've got is, and they should know, my God, they're married to them. They ought to know this. And I looked at them and I said, what do you mean you don't know? And they said, we just don't. And so that's how I got to Al-Anon. Now, that's a depressing way to have to get to Al-Anon. But did you know, I've never met anybody that when everything was going wonderful in their life, that they just happened to notice Al-Anon ad in the paper, were curious about what was going on, and decided to trip in. I've never known one to come like that. But I have seen a lot that come like me because there's nothing wrong with you. A lot of us seem to come like that there's nothing wrong with us. Okay. Blaming. I want to talk just a minute about blaming because that has a lot to do with step one for me. The blaming. If it's your fault, I've not got any hope at all. There's no hope because I'm powerless over you. But if it's my fault, I got hope because I can change what I'm doing to me. And it took me a long time to learn that principle as the first step. That blaming you all day long does not change one thing for me. And see, all my life I'd blame people. If you hadn't have done this, and if you hadn't have done that, and if you had have done this, or you had have done that, I'd be okay. And that's not the truth. The truth is how I react to what you do and don't do. It's what I do in relationship to what you're doing or not doing. So the blaming was one of the things that I had to give up. And I wasn't ready at first. I fought this program with every fiber of my being. I don't know if any of you are fighters out there. If you just came in and said, lay the Al-Anon sheet upon me, I'm ready to go. I fought it. And I would tell them why it wouldn't work. My sponsor had lots of exercises for me to do. Then I said, that doesn't make any sense. I said, that's not logical. She says, you're not either. She told me that she wanted to start my day off. She wanted me to get up, go into my bathroom, look in my mirror and say, good morning, Mary Pearl. There's nothing going to happen to you today that we can't get out of. Love God. And isn't that stupid? Is that stupid or what? And I told her, I said, I feel like a fool doing that. She said, better feel like one to act like one. She was a very cruel person. She had me doing lots of little things. I had little signs around the house. She made me put all these dumb little signs. You don't have to tell him what to do. I said, what do you mean I don't have to tell him what to do? Who will tell him? She said, God will tell him. Oh. I hate that. I wanted to tell him what to do. If I didn't tell him what to do, he didn't know what to do. And that was the truth. I told him so long what to do, he really didn't know what to do. You know, our literature says that when we do stuff for people, we make their failure to do it permanent. And that's what I'd done. He has a rotten sense of direction. Now, I don't know if he always had that, but I always pointed it out to him that you're going the wrong way. And I'd get him so nervous that even if he was started off the right way, he'd get confused and change it and end up going the wrong way. And I'd say, see, there you're going the wrong way. He told me, he said, I can't drive with you in the car. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you won't shut up. Well, we'll take two cars. And then I'd get lost. When he was drinking, I was telling him about driving. I said, I'll drive. You're drunk. You ain't got enough sense to drive. And I'm giving him this little sermonette while I ate the back end of a Toyota. And then I left the scene of the accident. I left to go find a telephone, and he's out wandering around with his bottle, you know. And the police came, and they tried to arrest me for drunken driving because they'd found alcohol in the car. Things like that were everyday occurrences in my life. Not that there was anything wrong with me. Okay. Could you say my life was unmanageable? I'll tell you about your life being unmanageable. I didn't think my life was. Do you know what my job was? I was a manager. I worked at an insurance company, the largest insurance legal reserve company in Arkansas, and I was in charge of a whole department, the sales force, for God's sake. And so I gave everybody their little marching orders every day, and I would tell everybody what to do. I was a good manager, but when I'd come home, J.D. would say, "You're not the foreman here." You know, he didn't like the managing. So it was real hard for me to see that my life was unmanageable when I was paid well to do what I did, and I did what I did well. Naturally, I love to manage. But some of the unmanageability in my life was not necessarily the little acts of things that I did that sort of screwed up. But my unmanageability came from thinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a strange way that I think, you know. I'll be laying there in bed. You go to bed at night, most people go in, lay down, go sleep. I didn't. I'd go in, lay down, and I'd think. And I'd plan tomorrow. Everything that was going to happen, I was going to say, they were going to say, he was going to do, I was going to do, we weren't going to this, we weren't going to that, and then I'd get up, and ain't nobody knew the plan but me. And then at the end of the day, I'd lay down, and I'd do a tent step on that, and I'd wonder where they went wrong. You know, I couldn't sleep at night because my mind was going all the time. My thoughts were becoming unmanageable. I couldn't keep myself. Do you have evil thoughts? And you knew they were evil thoughts, and they felt good. I had a lot of those, and I began to wonder. You know, the more I went to the meetings, the worse I got. It's the only program in the world that you go to well, and the longer you stay there, the sicker you get. Because people would say things in that meeting. Like, for instance, one girl came in and she talked about how that she had an expense account and that how she padded stuff and how dishonest that was and how she was having to make an amends, and I could have puked. I had an expense account. I had a petty cash drawer. That was enough to drive you crazy, trying to figure up in your mind now how much you'd robbed out of the petty cash drawer. You know. And my life was getting more unmanageable. The more I came to Al-Anon, my life began to get more unmanageable. I began to see all the dishonesty that was going through my life. And guess what? It wasn't anybody's fault but mine. And that makes it real unmanageable. And you don't want to think too long on that. I began to get scared a lot now. I began to see that I was powerless even over myself. Did you ever try not to do something? And you knew you shouldn't do it, but when you got there, you couldn't help yourself, and you did it anyway. And then my husband said, "That's just how I feel when I drink." I said, "God, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible." Because I didn't mean to be that way. I'd say, "This time, it's going to be different. This time." I'd lay in bed, and I'd look over at him first thing in the morning, and I'd say, "I wonder how our day's going to be." I'm turning my will and my life over to a recovering alcoholic. I didn't know I was doing that because what he did determined what I was going to do. If he did this, then I knew how to do this over here. I was a reactor. I didn't know how to do anything on my own. But if you'd have told me that, I wouldn't have believed that. I had to start seeing that I was reacting to everything. And when you're allowing somebody to be in control of your life, that's your higher power. So I'd check with my higher power every morning, you know, and see what I was supposed to do that day. And I did exactly what he said not to do. It's a little unmanageable. It's insanity, too. And that was where I began to see that there was some insanity in my life. But let's go back to the first step now. I'm standing here on the threshold of my first step, and I see that I'm powerless. I knew I could not keep the man from drinking. There wasn't a question in my mind. I can't keep him from drinking. I accept that. No problem. I didn't know I couldn't keep him from doing other things. I was not powerless over the man. And my sponsor had a lot of problem with me. She said, why don't you free him? She said, Lincoln freed the slaves. She said, there's a constitution that says he's entitled to the pursuit of happiness. I said, he is if he does it this way. I didn't know that. It didn't dawn on me that I was taking away someone else's freedom of choice when I was trying to manage and control them and fix them. So powerlessness means to me that what I'm doing is not producing any desired effect upon what I'm trying to manage. And if you're doing something and everything you're doing has no positive effect on it, chances are you're powerless over that. And that's the way I was over him. I was powerless to affect the change and get him to do what I wanted him to do. He would not manage. It's like trying to put a, you ever try to put him in a mold? I remember when I first met him and I was telling my family about him. He was so wonderful. He was so this. He was so that. Did you ever think about how you described your love partner until you got him? And then once you get them, you immediately say, now let's change them. If they're so wonderful, why is our first act to change them when we're powerless over them? J.D. said, you sold me a false bill of goods. He said, you were this sweet little old thing that never said anything, you know, and then all of a sudden you turned to this bitch that wouldn't do nothing. And I said, he was right. I had. Well, see, you do what's necessary to get them. You know, you even live with them for a while just to show them how wonderful it is. And then you get married and you say no. Yeah. So there wasn't much honesty, was there? There wasn't much honesty in our relationship. There wasn't any acceptance. I never accepted anything that wasn't the way I wanted it. You know, I have no problem with acceptance if everybody does it my way. None whatsoever. But people won't do it my way. Because, see, I always know best. I've got this brilliant mind that always knows how to handle every situation, even if I've never done it before. Now, there's some of you here who have heard about my toboggan ride. Well, see, there's a prime example of my superior type of intellect. I've never seen a toboggan before in my life, but I know how to ride one. Tina said the other day when she was watching the Olympics and saw that woman going down the luge, you know, they're hanging on for dear life, going in and out. I said, I could see myself doing that. And I bet you I could get on one of those things and finish ahead of them and not have one day of training. See, that's the way I would do myself. I would think myself into, that doesn't look hard. It surely ought to be this way. And it never entered my mind to ever ask anybody if it was. And I'd get into the most hellacious messes. Like there I was on a toboggan. Now, y'all have toboggans up here, I'm sure. Little old rounded front end on that little wood board. Well, in Arkansas, this year we had 4 years snow in one day. We got 16 inches of snow. Now, I never saw that much snow in Arkansas in my lifetime when I was a kid. 3 or 4 inches, and you'd get your sled out, and the sled had a little movable front end, and you could sort of guide it. And we had one little hill that if it got an inch of snow on it, we just went right down in the rocks and went down it. And so when I went to Newfoundland, the land of snow, I'm here to tell you, friends, there's snow in Newfoundland. There was 290 inches the first year I was there. I wanted to go up and get me a Christmas tree and come down on that toboggan. We're going to put the trees on the toboggan. It all sounds so good, don't it? You tie them on, you can bring them back. But I've never been able to leave anything alone. I have always got to modify the plan once it's being implemented. You improve upon the plan. Now, see, Al-Anon says if it works, don't fix it. But it was never good enough. You have to keep modifying the plan. So I get on. I said, why don't we ride down on top of the trees? So I've got, and I'll tie me on the front with a piece of leftover rope, and I've got 3 people behind me, and I'm coming down a huge mountain onto a road, and I'm coming fast, and I don't have any brakes. I didn't know that. I don't have any steering. I didn't know that. See, all this stuff I didn't know, but I got on that damn thing anyway. And I came tearing down that hill, and there were cars going back and forth on that road. And I shot between two of them. I went down about 18 or 20 steps, cut in the ice, and through the bottom of the house I lived in. It'd like to kill me. And my landlady came running out, and she says, what are you after doing, you crazy Yankee bitch? I looked up her and I said, "Don't call me no Yankee." I was not in control. Isn't it funny how I lost control the minute I got on the toboggan? But I had lost control before I went up the hill and didn't know it. And what has always amazed me, have you ever noticed I'm a natural born leader? I don't know how to follow. I either lead or I don't go. But I've always been able to find these idiots that will allow me to lead them. You know, if just once I could get somebody with some spine out there that would tell me you couldn't do it. You know, when babies are born, the doctor brings them in and says, "You have a boy, you have a little girl." And they brought me to my mama and said, "You got to fix her." Because I've always wanted to fix things when anything goes wrong. We were talking about that tonight's supper, you know. If the waitress doesn't do it right, we'll show her how. We'll fix it. We'll fix it. If you're not going down the road right, you know, I used to try to help people drive. I used to try to fix them. You know, I would encourage them with words of love and care and kindness and consideration. I would beat on their windows and tell them what they were doing wrong with their driving. You know, you drift away from normal living, from normal thinking, normal actions and reactions. And another word for action, normal here, could be socially acceptable, you know. You know, I didn't know what was normal a lot of times, but I had seen some guidelines of what is socially acceptable. Webster defines normal as being regular, natural, well-adjusted. My life did not fall under this category at all. My life was unmanageable because I had lost control of my emotions. I have been in self-will run riot for years. What I wanted, what I thought I wanted, what I thought I needed, what I wanted to do was the most important thing in the world. I was told in Al-Anon that in order to accept something, I didn't have to like it. Now that helps. I thought that when you accepted something, you put your stamp of approval on it and you said, "That's right, I agree with that." And that's not necessarily the case. I find that I have to accept the fact that there's war going on in the Mideast. I have no power to change that, but I have to accept the fact it exists. And that's like I had to accept the fact there was alcoholism in our home. I had to accept the fact that I was sick. I didn't like that. But you've got to be able to see it, recognize it, and accept it before you'll ever do anything about it. Because as long as I can deny it, I'll never do anything to change it. Why should I? It's not real. So acceptance makes it real for me. Now, alcoholism is a disease. They teach us that it's threefold, and that they either have abstinence, insanity, or death. Well, I believe Al-Anonism is the same way. We either have acceptance, insanity, or death. If we keep trying to change, you know, I always thought that the prayer said, change the things you can't accept. Change them till you get them acceptable. Sounds good, don't it? But that's not what it says. It says we have to learn that there's some things in this world that we have no power over, that we are totally powerless over. Al-Anonism, I love it. Ism, I like alcohol, ism. You know, I used to think because my husband wasn't drinking anymore and after a while he was going to get cured and he was going to get healthy. It don't ever go to Al-Anon wasm or alcohol wasm. It's always the ism in there, you know. That's that I, self, and me that wants us to be in charge. Okay, I used a lot of managing and controlling tools. Now see if you've ever used any of these or had them used on you. Why? Why'd you do that? Why do you think the way you do? Fast talking for slow thinking. I like that one. Nagging. Fear. Frustration. Crying. Threats. If you do that one more time. Violence. One of my favorites. The purse strings. I won't give you any money. Silence. I did not use this one much. Now, J.D. prayed for the silent treatment. You know, you have no life if you're living in someone else. And I didn't know that. You have no life if you're living. It's like that old Al-Anon joke, you know, that the Al-Anon fell in the water and was drowning, and her loved one's life passed before her very face. I knew how that went. I got up one morning, and it was the morning to take the dogs to the groomer. It's a very simple morning in our home. I have two poodles. They need to go to the groomer. I look at the calendar. It's his daughter's birthday. I look out the window. It's raining. He's getting drunk today. I knew it. His daughter didn't like him. It was a rainy, gloomy day. He was going to get drunk. So I woke him up. And I said, come on, we're going to take the dogs to the groomer. And he said, I don't want to go. I said, that has nothing to do with it. I said, we need to take the dogs to the groomer. You don't need to stay home by yourself today. I don't want to go. You want to get drunk, don't you? He said, why would I want to get drunk? Because it's Vicky's birthday and she hates you and it's raining. That's why. He said, I'm going to sleep. I said, not in this house, you will. I said, you're getting up and going to take the... He said, I'm not going. I've got to take the dogs because you get the appointment 2 months in advance. You can't afford to... I mean, I miss my doctor's appointment, but we do not miss the dog grooming appointment. First things first. So I was so mad, I got out of my car and I zoomed and I was about 8 blocks away and I said, shit, I forgot to put the dogs in the car. So I go back and I get the dogs. I came home later that day and he was reading his big book. Wasn't that disappointing? I was disappointed because I was wrong. But now that's how crazy you can get. I compared my situation to everybody else's. Did y'all ever do that? I would look at people down the street and I'd say, God, they have such a happy little home. Look at them. They're out there like a happy little family. The guy's mowing the grass. The wife is standing on the front porch looking sweet. You know, what did our house have? Well, we had weeds in the front yard, and they had this strange woman that came out in her nightgown and would make announcements for the neighborhood. I would say, attention, neighborhood! Attention, neighborhood! J.D. is an S.O.B. J.D., did you get that? They all felt sorry for J.D. My neighbor came over and asked me after J.D. was 4 or 5 years sober, she said, your husband doesn't drink anymore, does he? And I said, not today. And she said, I didn't think so. You hadn't been real weird in a long time. I don't think they noticed him that much. You know, our program is a spiritual sickness, so it requires a spiritual healing. And I think intuitively we sort of know that because one morning the police drug me home. I was sitting on the steps of a Methodist church about, 8 or so blocks from our house. I didn't go there. I was sitting there in my nightgown. I just decided I wasn't staying there with him anymore, passed out, not listening to me. But that's not crazy. You go into a bar, a place you wouldn't be caught dead in normally. And there he is, sitting over there with her. And you go over and you turn the table upside down, slap her flat, throw a drink in his face, and they throw you out. They have bouncers that throw you out when you're just there to save your home. It's cruel. It's cruel. You know, it's real funny. When J.D. and I first met, now that's sort of insane when I think about it. How did you meet yours? How did you meet your love of life? Was it a normal, everyday situation? Did you go to some... Did you meet in the choir? Surely you didn't meet in a bar. Surely you didn't. surely you did. I had joined the neighborhood softball team. It was our custom to go over to somebody's house after the game and discuss the game. Now, it was a mixed team. We had people of all ages, both sexes. It was a fun thing, you know. And it was everybody's turn to come over to my house, and this kid gets drunk at my house. Well, I didn't want to get in trouble with the sheriff for serving booze to a minor, so I drove him home. Isn't that noble? I'd already been in quite a bit of trouble with the sheriff of late, and I just didn't want to chance another go-round. I was known as the bizarre bitch that lived down the street. So it's around Mother's Day, and the kid had bought a china tea set for his mother. Now, get the picture. It's the wee hours of the morning. I'm going into a strange house with a drunken 18-year-old kid carrying a china tea set. Your everyday situation. And when he flips the light on in his bedroom, there's a man laying on the bed with nothing but his underwear on, and he looks up and says, "Hot damn, little brother, you brought us abroad home." That's my husband. That wasn't too sane, was it? Did you know that the bazaar was every day for me? It's insane to have a need for revenge. That's a form of insanity. But I always felt, see, it started back a long time ago. Revenge. Where did revenge come into my life? When I was doing a four-step, I found revenge. It happened when I was about 5. I went fishing. Mama and Daddy. I enjoyed going with Daddy. I couldn't stand Mother. Didn't even want her in the boat. Mother was out there, and I caught a little bitty fish. And my mother took one look at it, said, "It is not a keeper." And with that, she ripped it off my hook, threw it back in. Well, I went into a squalling coma right there. And my daddy said, "Honey, come in the back end of the boat and we'll get her." Now that sounds like fun. That sounds good to me, even at 5. And so every fish Mother would catch, she'd swing around. He'd take it off of her hook. He'd rebait her hook. She'd swing back around and give it to me, and I'd throw it over. Every fish she caught that day. So I learned how to get revenge. I learned when somebody does something ugly to you, you do something back to them as many times as you can. And that's what I had been doing up until yesterday. I've decided that, you know, that may not be the way to live. So after I divorced my first, I take that back. I had not, after, see, that's one of those little Freudian slips. I had separated from my husband. See, I had pretended in my mind that separated was divorced, and that gave me the freedom to act as if I was divorced when I was still married. But I wasn't ready to become self-supporting through my own voluntary contributions. In other words, I was getting an allotment check from the government. Well, some are sicker than others. And I met this boy that I knew was an alcoholic who lived across the street from me. It was my first experience with an active alcoholic since I had moved out of my mother's home with my grandfather. And this boy would go out and get drunk, come home and beat up his wife. So I knew he was one of them. And she was pregnant of all things. Now, isn't that a tacky thing to do, to come home and beat up a poor little old pregnant girl? Of course, she was probably standing at the door giving it this, like we do. But anyway, she came over to the house and she said, "Would you take me to the hospital? I'm in labor." And her eye was turning blue and her nose was bleeding. And it made me so mad. And I went over there and I thought, well, I'll help her pack. And all of a sudden I spied him laying there on the bed. And you know how they sort of pass out with that smirk? And I looked at him and I thought, you know, somebody ought to whip that sucker. I'm somebody. So I tied him up in his bed sheet and I beat the fool out of him. And then there was this other guy that lived on the other side of me, and he had weird hours. He was one of these people that got up in the morning at 8 o'clock or what have you and went to bed around 10. And see, I went to bed at 7 in the morning, and I got up around 1. I didn't work, just like the night hours. He would get out in his garden at 8 in the morning with a tiller right under my window. And I tried to explain to him about that, and he told me to shut my mouth and get my fat ass back in the house. He didn't hear about Mama and the fish, see. So I got a frog gig and headlight, and I mowed my grass at 11:30 at night. But that sheriff came to see me. Now, these are acts of insanity. And I do not believe that this is what the second step is talking about. That's the reason I wanted to tell you that. To me, what the second step is talking about is not these little isolated acts of insanity. It's that constant thinking that goes through my mind, going back to the same dumb stuff that's never worked and saying, this time it's going to be different. That is the insanity that I have to worry about. And I've gotten to the point now in my life, thank God, that when my mind tells me, this time it's going to be, I go, you're crazy. I recognize that insanity, and I believe that is God restoring me to sanity, to be able to recognize before I never did. It just was another way. We call it at home another way around Laurie's house. I had to find, if this doesn't work, I'll go around this way, and we'll do it this way. And if that don't work, we'll go into plan C. I believe every Al-Anon worth their salt has contingency plans. If this don't get them, then you go into plan B. And if plan B don't get them, you go into plan C. Because, see, this poor fool that told me to shut my mouth and get back in the house, my original plan was he has six beagles. Beagles bark. One beagle barks. Six, you've got a chorus. And I would wait till the wee hours of the morning, and I would go out, and I would take a broom handle, run up and down his dog yard fence, run back on my porch. And he'd come out, my God, them dogs would be wild. He'd come out in his drawer legs, he'd hose them down, cuss them out, scream, do all this kind of stuff. He'd get back in his house, we'd wait 30 minutes and do it one more time. But the sheriff came back to see me. So I'd go into the next contingency plan, and that's the insanity I'm talking about. That keep going back and keep going back and doing stuff over and over. It was that thinking that got me in trouble. Because see, when I thought up the original plan of the lawnmower, I already had contingency plan B, C, D, E, and F, which I implemented. And the sheriff came to see me every time. So I got the same results every time. Now, you would say, well, she's in Al-Anon now, and she's been restored to sanity somewhat, and she doesn't do weird things. I had been in the program over a year, and I went to Sears and Roebuck. Now, that is enough to test your serenity on a good day. I went to Sears and Roebuck and asked them for some joint cement. I wanted pre-mixed joint cement. Comes in a gallon like paint, ready to spread on the wall. Now, that's what I asked for. And the guy said, we have this powder here. And I said, no, I don't want powder. I want pre-mixed that's already like paste in a can. He said, well, we don't have it at this store, but they might have it at the other store. I said, would you call and see, lest I make the trip for nothing? He said, I'd be glad to. He called the store, the guy there, he even put me on the line to explain to the guy that I wanted in the can, the little mix, spread it on. The guy said, we have it. I said, now, I don't want the powder. He said, that's right, we've got it. I drove completely across two cities to the other Sears store, and he hands me a box of powder. He lied to me. He said, well, it will work up just like the other. This is not what I came for. And he said, so what? Now, he didn't realize he was talking to a woman who is an attempted murderess. You know, he didn't know. And there, I knew that I would be arrested if I did to him what I wanted to. I wanted to inflict pain upon his person. Great pain. I knew I couldn't say to him what I wanted to say without being thrown out of Sears. And then all of a sudden I saw my victim. It was a philodendron. It was right next to where he was standing, and I said, do you see this? This is what I'd like to do to you. And with that I grabbed it and I bit this philodendron to pieces. Now, this is after Al-Anon. Some of us are sicker than others. Okay. So, we have any problems with sanity? Okay. But the step on step two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. If there was any way I could restore myself to sanity, I would have. But it's hard for an insane person to become sane. You don't have the tools to work with. Because if you could, you would. So I had to have a power greater than myself. Well, I didn't like God. I'd been mad at God since I was 12 years old. I worshiped the ground my daddy walked on. My daddy spoiled me rotten. And my daddy died when I was 12 years old. I had gone to church. I had learned about a loving God. But a loving God supposedly took my daddy away from me. And I wouldn't forgive God for doing that. Because my life, as I knew it, changed so radically from the point I was 12 years old. I no longer felt loved. I never felt loved again after I was 12 years old until I came into Al-Anon. I had a hole inside of me from that point forward. And God did that to me. That was my attitude. I never expressed it, so no one was able to tell me any different. You know, it's not socially acceptable to say that you hate your mother and that you don't like God. That's not socially acceptable. So I kept those secrets deep inside of me. Now, some people have, I had an acquaintance with God. I had a gimme God. God, gimme this. God, gimme that. And on the reverse, I had the gotcha God. God got you when you didn't do right. And I didn't do right a lot, and I knew it, so I always felt guilty and I always felt fear. And I don't know about you, but I cannot get close to someone or someone that I'm afraid of. Just can't do it. I can't trust you if I'm afraid of you. So I didn't have any relation. I had a Santa Claus God. I made a list, and I knew he had a list, and he was checking it twice, and I'd always been naughty and never been nice. So I knew there was no hope there. I could see, if I had a picture of God in my mind, it was like Judge Wapner. Sarcastic and stern. That's how I saw it. I just had a hard time. But that's it. It says, come to believe that a power greater than yourself. So I would keep coming to the meetings and coming to the meetings, and other people began to share their God with me. And the way they began to share their God with me, with people would say, let me tell you what God did for me today. I prayed and God did this, and I thought, oh, blah. You know, that's just a bunch of bull. That's a coincidence. I mean, these people are freaky people here. They take a little bit thing. I had a hangnail and then it fell off. God did that. Just makes you sick at your stomach, you know? And they went around saying, let go and let God, let go. Blah. I just hated all those old slogans. Hated it. And I could see a lot of them, they'd talk about what God did for them and everything. I'd say, well, I can see why God do that for you. You look like a pretty nice person. But you don't know what I've done. And there's no way in the world that God is going to love me for what I've done. I had such a thing of unworthiness that I could not believe that God would help me. Could not. But then, you know, as time goes on and people share, you get a little more courage to try to see. Now, my car was screwing up bad. J.D. had been off work. Like I say, he got fired, so he'd been off work for a long time. Finances were really critical. And my car now began to give me trouble. I'd be going down the road, and I love the lessons God's give you. You see, all of a sudden, my car would turn itself off. It didn't have any power. It was powerless. And I couldn't understand, so I finally got a guy at the service station to look at it, and he said, your carburetor's full of trash and dirt. The carburetor's like the heart on your car. He said, it's full of trash and dirt. And he said, what you might can do until you can get that cleaned out and fixed, he said, you might can pour a little gas through the top. It might backfire enough to where it dislodged that trash so that you could get on down the road. And I said, we'll do it. Half measures avail us nothing. But I'm going to try. And it worked for about 2 weeks. And then you was having to do it every day. Every couple of times a day, there's a guy back there who's had a sick carburetor. Then you was having to do it three, and that gets on your nerves. Really gets on your nerves bad. And I had about a 2-mile trip to go from Mama's home one night, and that thing stopped on me, and I got it, and I was so frustrated I had it. I had just had it with that car.